And welcome to another episode of Nights at the Round Table. It's your boy, Man Weezy. I got Be Real here to the right.
What's up?
Chilling. And we are joined by Erica. Erica, where are you at?
I'm in Philly.
Philly?
Yep.
You a Philly girl? Like born and raised? Or this is just...
Not born and raised. But I've been in the... I'm from like middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. But I've been a Philly girl for 20 years now. So I'm pretty set in. Yeah.
I like... Look, Philly is one of my fave cities. Only because of the history. So if you don't know me, like I'm a big history buff. So Boston, New York, Philly, DC, all some of my faves just because the architecture, everything is so dope.
Yeah.
Well, good on you. We're talking sex today. And it's one of our favorite topics to talk about only because people get squeamish talking about it. I don't know why, but it's one
certain,
of those.
Certain people, you're right. Certain people get very squeamish about it.
Let me stop. Certain people from certain evangelical cultures get squirmish about it. But we were talking about this off camera, but you said that your family has its roots in Christian origin, but you yourself have in it, out it. What's your story?
Yeah, so my family is what I would consider casually Christian, culturally Christian, but the only time we ever went to church was occasionally on Christmas Eve. We were like those people.
Yeah.
You know, we'd have like a Christmas dinner and an Easter dinner, but nothing about it was religious. It was like maybe my dad would say a prayer before dinner.
Okay.
So I did not grow up going to church. I did not grow up with a scary version of God. That's my background.
Yeah, so, but a lot of people, and correct me if I'm wrong at this, but do you find yourself that a lot of, I don't know if it would be ex-evangelicals or maybe closeted people who have questions about sex hit you up the most?
At this point, it's a lot of ex-evangelicals and a lot of people who were raised in some kind of fundamentalist religion that hit me up the most because I've kind of made it my business to tailor my education to those people.
Ooh, and you said education. What's the proper way to ask this? Like school education or real world education?
Sex education, which is so much broader than most people think.
I'd imagine.
It's, you know, I think when people hear the term sex education, they tend to think it's learning what you might have learned in high school, which is about condoms, which is about pregnancy, and which is about you're going to die if you do it. But there's so much more. I mean, none of that is the whole picture. There's a lot more to know in the field of sex education. So it's not just learning about bodies and the bad things that can happen. It's talking about relationships and what's normal development, what's healthy, how to interact with other people, pleasure, all of that stuff. So that's that kind of education.
So what would be your one thing that you are trying to get across? Like, what's your mantra? Like when you bring yourself to a situation, whether it's a couple or whether it's one person, like I'm assuming you have an end goal. You're like, I want to bring you here. What is that?
I just want people to not feel shame about something that is a completely fucking normal part of being a human.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty good. That's a pretty good summary.
That's good, to the point. Now, talk a little bit about just your background. How'd you get into this of actually teaching kind of sex education to, you know, the people who you're teaching this to? Because, you know, I'd imagine, you know, most people kind of have some experiences young, whatever, and they kind of learn about it a little bit and, you know, you're off, you're kind of experimenting a little bit, then what kind of honed in for you that you're like, hey, this is actually something that, one, I enjoy teaching, two, I'm seeing the impact that it's having in people's lives. Share a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I've been doing this work since I was in college, and that was a long-ass time ago. I was in college, and I graduated college in 2001, so I started... I was at Penn State University and my friends and I did a lot of feminist activism. And one of the things that we liked to talk about the most was sex, not just saying this is, you know, we're talking about sexual assault because that gets talked about a lot in the feminist context. But we wanted to talk about the fun of sex, the good things about sex, how it's like a good part of life. And that became something that I just found that I was so interested in. And I was also good at. So my major in college was women's studies, but I specialized in women's health. And after college, I had my first jobs were in reproductive health clinics, teaching people about STIs, their bodies. I worked in an abortion clinic for a while. And then I got a job that I had for years, which was teaching sex ed and HIV prevention in Philadelphia's Juvenile Detention Center.
Wow.
Yeah. So I worked with kids in detention for 17 years, just like inside the center teaching sex ed. And I just feel like it's one of those things that it's such important knowledge to have. It's knowledge that is applicable to everybody, but nobody teaches this to us. Nobody wants to talk about it. And there are people out there who would prefer that we didn't ever talk about it.
Yeah.
People out there who have it on their agenda to explicitly keep this info from people.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, why? I mean, I know why, but if like,
wait, why is the why? Tell us why.
Why people want to keep that info?
Yeah,
from
yeah,
us?
Yeah. I want to know.
Oh God, it's such a big answer. The religious right in America, the conservative Christians, they don't want us to have this information about our bodies because it's something that they would rather use to control people. So control people's decisions, control what kind of family structures they make, and they seem to think it's best to keep people completely in the dark about sex, about their bodies, about queer identities, about all kinds of different things. And none of that has ever been beneficial to people.
Sure. I think that's where the shame part comes in of what you were talking about. At least that's what, when I was, you know, I mean, I'm still a believer, but when I was beginning in it, it was an area of shame that it was like, man, if you fucked up in this area, you're done. Like, this is hell worthy. So it was like, I was continually breaking up with girlfriends. If we did some kind of mistake, I'm like breaking up because it was like, oh, this ain't pure anymore. So I guess I gotta keep it moving. You know, I'm interested in the people that you talk to from this background. What is the number one repetitive view on what sex is? Like, what do you constantly have to like rewire? I'm assuming there's maybe a baseline since they're all coming from the same, well, not all, but a good amount is coming from the same background. Is there like a typical viewpoint that you keep finding yourself like, oh damn, this one again?
There's a lot of them. One of them is that desiring someone and wanting to have sex with them means that you are disrespecting them or that you don't respect them. So I get a lot of people who are like, you know, I think this girl's really cute, but if I find her attractive, I start feeling like I'm not respecting her. Or Sheesh. People will say they're uncomfortable if someone finds them attractive because they've been taught that to find someone sexually attractive is to be dehumanizing them.
Yeah.
So they're so uncomfortable even with the notion of sexual attraction and desire, which I love to remind people is just such a normal is a strange word to use, but it is a very typical part of the human experience. And there's nothing shameful about your body working in the way that it was meant to work.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Ange used to always be like that. She didn't want attention on her. She always felt she dressed a certain type of way. And
it's
was like,
it's even different too for women who grew up in that culture.
Yeah.
Right. Like men, there was a little bit of this, like, you know, that you got to kind of mess up, but redeem yourself, you know, but for women who grew up, especially in purity culture, it was one of those things of like, hey, you're like this delicate flower. And essentially like you have sex and you lose that.
Yeah.
Like you are like that flower is not getting put back together. You know what I'm saying? Like, and it would all of a sudden cut you off from this future, like prosperous, blessed marriage with this one man that found it the most attractive thing in the world that you had kept your purity.
Mm-hmm.
That's so much pressure, right? Like,
and unrealistic in this world. I mean, Ange was a virgin when we got married, so that was pretty surprising. But at this point, which kind of leads me, because you spoke about feminism earlier. in what you were really into in college. Is there a difference? Because that was 2001. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference, 2001 feminism to 2023 feminism? Because I feel like there's a massive difference.
There's a lot more stuff that we talk about now and that we're aware of now that we didn't talk about before. That's such a large question to answer, but like gender is one of them. I mean, now, like I graduated from a program that was called Women's Studies, but now most programs that were called Women's Studies are called like Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. So we've really started to, over the last, I don't know, 20 years, broaden our thinking around womanhood, around gender roles, and just to mention a few things.
Sure. Yeah, because I have this conversation with some of my friends that are women that I end up talking to that are, they've embodied, which it's kind of like a catch 22. They've embodied their sexuality, right? Which is awesome because for a while it was shameful, right? So it's like, no, it's okay to be sexy. It's okay to love my body. It's okay to whatever, right? But do you think that this version of feminism at all pushes like the promiscuity side of things too much to where it's like, oh, you can go out and just have sex anytime because it's owning your sexuality? Do you find that to be true? And does it have negative effects on people that you speak to?
That is a great question. And I think the main thing I would want to say is that I don't think any extreme is going to be healthy for most people.
Right.
So whether that is the extreme of, you know, I'm not even going to have a sexual thought or feeling and I'm not going to hold someone's hand.
Yeah.
Right. That is repressive. And I would consider that on one end of the spectrum. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, that might be someone who, I don't know. I mean, people absolutely can have a lot of sex with a lot of partners and feel good about it as long as they are doing it out of a genuine desire to be doing that and know what their reasons are and aren't doing it because they feel pressured or because they feel like it's what they have to do to be liberated. I tell people all the time that the opposite of purity culture is not just going out and doing every sexual thing that you can check off a list because you think you have to. That's not the opposite of purity culture. And it's not even how to recover from purity culture. It's some people will end up on more on that end of the spectrum where they do enjoy a lot of partners or a lot of casual sex or a lot of activities or, you know, things that we would consider pretty taboo. And if you land there because that is genuinely who you are, I think that's wonderful. But a lot of people will go there immediately because they think they have to. They're like, I gotta try all this and that's how I get liberated. And I don't know, people have a variety of experiences with that. And I think that it can be, I guess a bit dangerous to dive right into that end of things without genuinely thinking about why and what your motivations are and if that's what you really want to be doing.
Right. Yeah. We always joke about hoe phases.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, yeah, if we ever stop being married, I think there will be a hoe phase somewhere in there. Yeah. Like if I
hoe phases are part of a lot of people's sexual journey, you know? Might be short ones, might be a longer period of time, might be something you try and you're like, I'm actually not a hoe. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I know for sure. I would just not be a hoe. Like, you know, I'm a romantic at heart, so I would just get.
Yeah, no, I'd like, play myself out. I always laugh at myself. Because even when I wasn't, you know, when I didn't even know Jesus, I was out here like one woman guy, you know, I was super, you know, wanted to have real connection, wanted to have it. And it needed to mean something. It couldn't just be like, whatever. Yeah. I'm not a typical dude in that regard. You know what I'm saying?
But you know that about yourself. And I love that. That's one thing I want people to be in touch with what works for them. And it sounds like you know what works for you.
Yeah. How long have you been married?
Since 2015.
Okay. And what does hubby think of your work?
Of my work? I mean, he is 100% on board with it. I mean, he's a social worker. He does, you know, he doesn't do sexuality work, but yeah. I was already well into this career when we met. So there was, you know, it's either you accept what I do or I would never, I'm like, it wouldn't have gotten past a first date if this work wasn't cool.
Yeah.
Like, no, I ain't with it.
Yeah. I'm like, nah.
Don't teach me anything about sex.
I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, just that time where you were working with kids who were in the system. Mm-hmm. Now, what did those lessons look like? Because one of the things I was thinking about earlier when I knew we were going to have this conversation was I thought about, I grew up here in California, specifically Northern California. And I remember in fifth grade taking home a VHS that was like part of the sex education. And what was crazy about it was I remember there was this form that you had to fill out or your parents had to fill out. And they had to say like, hey, Brandon, watch this with me or whatever. So I remember we're sitting in the living room. My dad, I think, was out of town because it was me and my mom. We're sitting next to each other on the couch. We pop in this VHS and it was like this like hour long sex education video. I don't remember much from it, but I do remember just feeling like so awkward. But,
yeah.
You know, you're like seeing stuff. And I think that they actually showed like an actual penis and vagina on there. I'm pretty sure they did. I could be wrong.
California probably had better sex ed. I don't know. Maybe if that was that the 90s or the 2000s.
It was the early 2000s.
Yeah. I feel like California probably had decent sex ed then.
So I just remember that, you know, and then obviously I think the next year was the first time that I saw any sort of porn video. So I was in sixth grade. I remember I was at the time, he's my best friend. His older brother had some porn on his computer or whatever. And remember the first time that I saw that in comparison to like, you know, in the sex education video, something like not graphic like that.
Yeah.
But you're kind of like, oh, okay. And then the first time that I saw a porn video, I remember the feeling. Like I still remember the image. Mm-hmm. Like it's so like, it's crazy. And I just remember feeling like, whoa, oh my gosh, like I shouldn't be looking at this, but I can't stop looking at this, you know?
Yeah. You and knew so, there was a different intent with that video. That video was made for arousal.
And what's crazy now is like, I think like, even if I was growing up today, like just the access that you have to those sort of, you know, images and everything, like it's right here on your phone. It's on TikTok. It's on Twitter. It's on Instagram. If you're looking in places, apparently.
Yeah.
So like just the difference. So like going back and what would be some like core things in restructuring and introducing like these younger people to sex education, what would be some core things, or maybe the question is core values that you would present to them to have a healthy view of sex?
Oh yeah, I love that question. So yeah, all of the young people that I was working with were involved in the system. They were either delinquent or dependent youth, and they were in the custody of the city of Philadelphia. Some of them were in the custody of the state. And most young people that end up spending time in detention have pretty chaotic lives and often traumatic backgrounds that include abuse, neglect. Some of them, I mean, a large number of them had sexual abuse in their backgrounds. So we're talking about a population of kids that already had a different playing field than most people. And my program specifically targeted kids that were considered high risk for STDs or pregnancy or other unwanted outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so the young people I was talking to, most of the time had already had sex, had a lot of it. And so we would start with talking about like their values. Like, where did you learn about sex? And what do boys say about sex? And who taught you that stuff? And it was always like some old head told them it was like some old head told me this. And it would always be some usually rooted in misogyny, like not true thing about sex. So my best friend and I actually ran that program together, and she and I spent so much time just correcting misinformation. That was one place we started. Because they'd be like, well, I heard that a girl could, like, you've probably heard this, that a girl could have no walls. Yeah. I'm like, you know what I'm talking about. Okay.
No walls?
Well, that's the, I mean, that was at least the Philly way of saying that a woman was loose.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never heard that before, but yeah. I am old.
Like, that girl has no walls. And we'd be like, yeah, that's not a thing that can happen. I mean, no matter how much sex a vagina has, they're quite elastic and you're never going to know. But they would hear all this stuff from the men in their lives, from the women in their lives. And it took a lot of usually asking the young people, like, what do you believe? What did you hear? Mm-hmm. And tell me about your experiences. And then we would just establish a rapport where we could correct the misinformation slowly.
Yeah.
And then add in, you know, the facts that we wanted to teach them about how to be safe and how they could begin to make safer decisions for themselves. Yeah. And our goal was never to say, you need to do this, you have to do this. It was always like, hey, you know, seems like you care about your health. I bet you would probably want to use condoms most of the time. Does that feel like an accessible thing to you? Do you know where to get them? Do you know how to put them on? Mm-hmm. Do you know what to say if the guy doesn't want to use one? So a lot of conversations like that where we'd attack things from many angles.
Yeah, that's good.
Mm. Nina Valdez says, Missouri sex ed, the only penis or vagina that you see are the STD affected ones. Disturbing, makes the kids not want to do anything.
Oh yeah. I never I never use those images. I would only ever share images of STIs if people asked for them. So sometimes a kid would be like, what do herpes look like? And I'd look it up for them and I'd make sure I was finding a picture that showed their skin tone, because if you just search like herpes, a lot of times you're going to get like a white body and I'm like, it's not going to look the same on everybody.
Yeah.
But using those images alone is a absolutely ineffective way to teach people about sex, just scaring them. It's like, yeah. None of that. You can't connect with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's something that's, I mean, I don't know if I'm just getting old, but it's for sure something that is, I would bet everyone is partaking of, and it's young. Like, I feel like I started young. I was 14, but that was like rare and I was all like about it. But it's like now, bruh, because of the phone, because of porn, it's like, it's starting young, like, well, really young.
You mean like sex?
Just
like
wanting to, yeah, wanting to do it, having it.
One of the interesting things is that the government or the CDC looks at data showing how many high schoolers are sexually active, it's so much lower than it was in like 1998. The amount of young people, school age kids who have had sex by the time they graduate is so much lower than it was 20 years ago.
What do they attribute that to? Like, what are the, in your opinion, what are the things that are influencing less young people having sex?
That's a baffling statistic.
It is a baffling statistic, but I think it's so interesting because we always assume that younger people are doing shit that's like way crazier than we were. Honestly, I attribute some of it to technology. Like, we are connected to our friends all the fucking time in our houses. We're not out in the back of cars as much. We're not like, you know, cruising or like out, you know, in the streets. I don't think young people are like having the same kind of adolescence where they're just always with each other in a physical place. I do think that technology and the internet and kind of the proliferation of smartphones and social media has reduced the time that young people spend together. I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Do you think also that it's maybe because of technology, the gap between the haves and have nots sexually gets a lot wider? Does that make sense? Like, I feel like what I see now is, at least what's being promoted to women, is there's a type of guy that you go after. You know what I'm saying? And it's specific. It's the cool guy. It's the guy with the money. It's the athlete. It's the whatever. And because I always watch a lot of podcasts and I read a lot of stuff that talks about how it's the top percentage of guys that get most of it. Most normal dudes are not getting it. Women, on the other hand, you know, I assume access is a lot easier because there's always going to be a guy that's down to go for it. You know what I'm saying? But it's not the other way around. Yeah, if you're not picky, you can get on your DMs and you can find something tonight.
Totally.
But for a guy, it's not the same. Like, it really is a wider gap because of what now is considered. And I think technology has to do with that. Because if it's kind of like us, if we're constantly seeing hot girls all the time in our feeds, then now there's a standard of like what you like that becomes normal to see that. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know. I don't know if that's something that could be backed statistically, but that's like something that I always hear people saying.
Yeah.
That the gap is getting wider.
I think it's probably so complicated and complex to untangle to begin to understand, like, the way that technology has influenced our sexuality compared to what we had when you all were in high school, when we, you know, when all of us were in high school. It's so different that I don't think we will understand for a long time how much just having the technology we have affects our relationship to sex. Because now, I know you all mentioned, like, you know, porn is everywhere. It's on our phones. It's no longer like you find a magazine in the woods kind of deal.
Right.
But we are also able to make our own content, our own sexualized content. And that was never a thing that people did. You know, no one in the 90s was going through all the effort of like taking photos. I mean, maybe some people taking photos on a camera and then getting them developed at the drugstore.
Like
having that person see your nudes. Like, you know, but now it's like anyone can create their own sexualized content, which means that we are viewing ourselves through this sexualized lens in a much different way nowadays, if you were a young person, than we would have even had available to us when we were young.
I mean, all that can happen in your room in one night. You could set up an OnlyFans, you can take the pictures, you can do the thing, and you're going.
Would you say as a result of that, what you just said, of now, you know, just your normal person has the access to create sexualized content, as a result of that, would this generation be considered the most sexually liberated?
That's a great question. I think in a lot of ways, this generation is not as sexually liberated. There's a lot of young people online that I see saying things that seem very puritanical to me. You know, sexual liberation is defined differently by people. So I don't think that having access to cameras and the ability to create content is necessarily what would make someone more sexually liberated.
Gotcha.
What's your definition for sexual liberation?
It's a great question. I would say sexual liberation to me is when you are free to make the best decisions for you and you have what you need to do that and feel safe. So if you want to have sex with someone that you feel like you are doing that from a place that feels good to you, that feels empowered to you, and that you feel like you aren't making that decision because you are forced to or you have to, or some, you know, it's in exchange for someone's respect. I think sexual liberation is when you're able to make those decisions for yourself. And
question then, do you feel like, because that's such a well-balanced answer, right? But do you talk to a lot of people that think that balanced before engaging? Because a lot of the girls that I talk to or dudes that I talk to, like, they're usually engaging from a negative space. Loneliness, boredom, I have my needs. I have rarely ever heard somebody that was like, yeah, I hooked up with them. Well, why? Because there was this real deep connection and I felt safe and seen with him. I'm more so here, I was bored. Or I just wanted to do it. Like, I don't know. Do you like know of a lot of people that are that balanced before engaging into it, like sex?
There absolutely are. And I think that that is something you have to work on and you have to learn. whenever studies are done about like the effects of casual sex on someone's mental health, they tend to show that it's only negative if people are doing it because they feel like they have to, or because they don't really know why, or because they're peer pressured or somehow feel obligated. But when someone's making, you know, decisions like to have sex with multiple partners or outside of a committed relationship from a place of like, yeah, I know I actually want this, then there's not that kind of shame and guilt attached. And when I work with clients, that's something, you know, we talk about all of this, especially for people that were raised in purity culture. The shame is such a baked in part of sex for a lot of people that we do a lot of talking about, like, you know, if you have sex because you really want to, there's no shame in that. And if you have sex because you genuinely want to do it, there's nothing to be ashamed of as long as everyone is consenting. So that was a long answer, but yes, there are people out there that are making really good intentional decisions to have sex and not just doing it because they're like, I was bored. But you know, that's okay too, as long as everyone's consenting.
Thanks so much, y'all, for listening to part one of this episode. We appreciate it greatly. Hey, like and subscribe if you guys are feeling this. Share it with your friends. We appreciate it so much. Please come back next week for part two. Love you.